Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The recession. This week's online video picks are up on our website, where we make a little bit of light, of the recession. They are mostly musical video picks this week. See Arlo Guthrie's new version of Changing My Name to Chrysler for the new bailout era, and Tom Paxton's update, which is Changing My Name to Fannie Mae. Also this week, it's Proposition 8, the musical, in our online video picks. Go to WNYC.org/video. You'll definitely enjoy those video picks. Now, this week we've been hearing about billions of dollars evaporating from corporate and individual coffers, not because of the recession per se, but from what some are calling the biggest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history, Bernard Madoff. A big deal among Wall Street types and investors all over the world, but he was also a key player in the philanthropic world. Foundations and individual charities that invested money through Madoff's firm are now buckling in the fallout. This is such a tragedy, and it looks like Jewish charities are being hit particularly hard. He was a big deal in the Palm Beach Jewish community in particular, somewhat here in New York, and he's really done this to his own. But who's responsible? The Securities and Exchange Commission admits to dropping the ball, and middle managers are getting sued now by their clients, even though they were duped themselves. So to talk about what the fallout will look like, who might be held responsible, and some of the developments today, which keep surprising by the way these are going, we are joined by Dennis Berman, deputy editor of the Money and Investing section of the Wall Street Journal, who has written an article about this in today's paper, and will even play a clip of Madoff himself kind of making fun of regulators from a YouTube clip that has surfaced. And Dennis Berman, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. I love your show. Listen to it. So happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Happy to have you. And let's start with the really heartbreaking part first. How central was Madoff to the world of Jewish charities, particularly in New York?
Well, I spoke to someone the other day and asked him that same question. This is someone sort of in the center of the Jewish charitable world, and he used the word atomic bomb, as an atomic bomb had gone off in that world. And it's pretty incredible when you do count up the casualties that have just been revealed, and there will be far, far more. But so many different programs. There's a psychoanalyst's journal that was a particular cause of someone close to Madoff. There are programs for death row inmates, the Innocence Project that checks on death row inmates' DNA. And then there are all sort of the standard charitable donations that form the fabric of sort of Jewish philanthropic life here, be it helping people in Israel, helping Jewish education, helping religious schools. It's all taken a severe hit from the Bernie Madoff scandal.
One example from your article, the JEHT Foundation, that focuses on juvenile justice and other social justice work. They've said that they are stopping all grant making and will shut down at the end of January because almost all of their major donors had their money invested with Madoff.
Right, and there you begin to understand the true fallout here. It wasn't just Madoff himself. It wasn't just charities that were significantly invested in Madoff. It was the whole network of people who were invested in Madoff who formed their own charitable world. So we have a list of those individuals who have private organizations or private foundations who had significant exposure to Madoff, and it's in the dozens and in the scores, and that's probably not all of them. So it's incredible when you look at the social connections sort of linking into the charitable connections. We're just really just beginning to understand how broad this is going to spread.
And some of the tentacles there, JEHT gives money to the Innocence Project, which you mentioned before, which a lot of our listeners know. They've done such amazing work, really, the Innocence Project, in finding people convicted of murder, even, who are actually innocent by doing this work. Human Rights First, one of the major human rights organizations in the world, formerly known as the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. How much of their funding do they lose as a result of JEHT going down?
Well, I can't tell you the individual amounts and how that was a percentage of their budgets, but these organizations are they usually have a specific profile, and that's profile very small budgets, a core group of committed people to who run them, and also a core group of funders who really form the bulk of the money that's used to operate these organizations. And in the charitable world, they talk about two sides of the scale. One is lots of little donations that make up maybe 10% of an operating budget, and then the 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 big fish who comprise 90 or 80% mm-hmm. of an organization's funding.
And JEHT was one of those big fish
right.
for a number of charities. Elie Wiesel's foundation invested about $37 million with Madoff, which has disappeared.
Yeah, again, it's a real disgrace. One thing that's really come up over the last 10 years is the rise of the individual foundation. These have become individual projects of wealthy people. Now, before, over the last, say, 50 years prior to that, particularly in Jewish circles, rich people would give money to an overall umbrella organization that would distribute the money as it saw fit. It was more of a communal thing. On a secular basis and in both the Jewish community over the last few decades, there's been a rise of the individual foundation. It's both a you know, sort of tax benefit. It's also a vanity thing. If you have the money, perhaps you want a little more credit for giving it away. And those individual foundations perhaps have less of an infrastructure to monitor how they spend their money and do the due diligence for people with whom they entrust their money. So that's why you see a lot of these small foundations giving so much to Bernie Madoff, because he was a trusted individual and everything would be fine with Bernie. At least that was the idea. So you really see a lot of trends in philanthropy really get sort of blown up in the last week or so because of the Madoff scandal.
Dennis Berman, my guest on WNYC, doing a good job covering the Madoff scandal for the Wall Street Journal. He's deputy editor of the Money and Investing section, and we can take your comments on the charity aspects or your questions if you're trying to understand this alleged Ponzi scheme, $50 billion reportedly up in smoke. 212-433-WNYC or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. For Dennis Berman from the Journal, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And it's really complicated and so, you know, kind of darkly fascinating to see how this Ponzi scheme worked and how he kept it going for so long. For example, there was one couple profiled in one of the other papers that basically lost their life savings. They're elderly, but they had been living off the interest from their life savings, or I guess the earnings that their life savings that they had with Madoff for the last 10 years. So they were getting their 10 or 12% every year for 10 years on their nest egg before this thing went down. So he was actually paying out.
He was paying out, and in a market that's rising, it's far easier to keep something going. Again, we don't quite know when the scam began, whether it started out legitimately and then just over the last year or so things ran out. That's one thing investigators and frankly the press just haven't figured out yet. But everything is much easier in an up market. And in a down market, the pressures really begin to reveal themselves. And they've begun to reveal themselves across the financial system. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that later. But from this perspective, the redemptions that people were making in the Madoff funds were obviously putting pressure on him to deliver the payouts that he had promised. But I think on the face of it, to say that one is going to receive 10 to 12% every year without interruption, one should be skeptical of such a claim. Most investors would be overjoyed to have such a consistent track record.
But look who wasn't skeptical. Frank Lautenberg, Mort Zuckerman, Fred Wilpon, Elie Wiesel, apparently.
Just amazing, right? So maybe it's heartening in its own twisted way that as each of us, as far poorer individuals, struggle to make investment decisions that even the people at the top of their game cannot do any better than us. So
then
maybe
again,
we can take perverse satisfaction in that.
On the other hand, maybe it's you know, as surprising or more that everybody thought that credit default swaps and collateralized debt orders were going to, you know, that you could invest in generations and generations of people's subprime mortgages and that those were going to give you safe returns.
Well, those were pretty silly probably to begin with, and a lot of A lot of people knew it, but the greed impulse, the infrastructure of Wall Street to create the belief that there's a way to beat the market, all those things added up over the last 10 years and created the world that we came to live in. Now we're beginning to understand that it's such a basic thing, right? But obviously we don't learn, and we're beginning to understand that none of that really applies. You have to be skeptical, you have to respect the law of averages, and you have to behave accordingly.
Jonathan in Lawrence, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Not too good. I'm actually a former, I guess, investor in the Madoff Fund.
I'm sorry.
And, you know, I guess I agree with some of what you say. Probably not everything, because there are going to be some guys like Buffett, who are going to have those outsized averages year after year, who actually can beat the system. But the question is, you know, regulation, you know, we've seen how much can you regulate certain people. Also, just on a separate note, I was just curious on what you think, if there's going to be an anti-Semitic backlash against this event.
Well, I guess it's always possible when a Jewish person gets caught doing something wrong. Hopefully that will be mitigated by the fact that so many of his victims were other Jews, and he was really mostly ripping off his own in that respect.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to the nature of what happened here, and that it was a social thing. It was far less economic than more of a social dynamic. So if one heard, oh, you were in Madoff, well, you were in the club, right? This is a typical part of what they call affinity fraud. But
I definitely have to agree with you on that one, actually. You know, it was the topic most discussed in synagogue this past week, and I have to say I know, unfortunately, a number of my friends who invested with him, and actually the father of one of my friends ran Ascot Partners, which lost I think $1.7 billion.
And wow! And Jonathan, how did you get involved? Because I gather there was, you know, you had to know somebody to get in, right?
Actually, years ago, through my father, who has been in it for 25 years, you know, and luckily we, you know, my father is very fiscally conservative and only invested, you know. Even though he was being encouraged to put more and more in, he definitely, you know, diversified. But some people
Good.
Have just been completely, you know, like Yeshiva University.
Another obviously Jewish victim. It's so, so sad. Jonathan, hang on for a second. Thanks very much for your call. Jeff in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I worked on Wall Street for 25 years, and one of the things that nobody's talking about, although there are some blog entries on the web that you can find, is that people who invested with Madoff believed that he was capable of generating returns like the ones that he promised because of his trading operation. They thought that he was a cheater in the trading operation and that he was their cheater, and they trusted him. That's one of the problems here. One of the other problems here is that any charity that would put 100% of its foundation into one money management firm, the board of that charity should be culpable, because that is ludicrous investment management, silly portfolio management, and it's just plain dumb.
Dennis,
you don't give 100% of your assets to anybody.
Dennis Berman from the Wall Street Journal. What do you say to Jeff?
He's right. That's basic portfolio theory, probably what you learn on day two in business school. I think that there was, over time, there was this perception that Bernie was his own entity, that he had almost this calming influence on people, that he would get 10% reliably, whether the market was up, whether the market was down. And people, I think, focused on that consistency as an indicator of their confidence in him. But your caller is exactly right. It's so simple and so dumb that people didn't pay attention to that.
Jeff, thank you for your call. Well, is that where the lawsuit filed by New York Law School against Ascot Partners comes in? This is a fund managed by Ezra Merkin, who invested almost all of the $1.8 billion fund in Madoff. Now, New York Law School is not suing Madoff. They're suing Ascot. So why would the middlemen be liable for the Madoff scam if they got scammed themselves?
Well, the middleman's job is to make sure that the end investor doesn't get scammed. People pay huge fees to the, quote, funds of funds to help them pick their investments and to do due diligence on places where they do put their money. So that is the express function of funds like Ascot, and to complete that mission is certainly grounds for an investigation from a legal standpoint.
What is Ascot Partners exactly?
Ascot Partners was it's a fund of funds that was run by Mr. Merkin, and I forget the exact percentage, but a very, very large percentage of its money into the Madoff funds. And what was interesting about Ascot was that it didn't necessarily advertise what where its money was going. It talked about some other funds where it placed its money, but I don't think that the end customers knew necessarily that so much of their money was going into Madoff, and that's why, pardon me, and that's why you had so much investigation into whether that was represented to them correctly.
And did Ascot specialize in investing the money of not-for-profits?
I don't know the answer to that. The idea was that it was sort of a Madoff copycat, that it was Madoff-esque, if we may use the adjective, and that's why it appealed to people. Again, this is if you diagram the social networks that where the money was fed into, if you put Merkin next to Madoff, next to Noel, who ran Fairfield, which is another feeder fund, it's a small world of people. Yeah. You know, a lot of them go to Palm Beach, they go to New York, they all know each other. There's a social acceptance, there's a social blessing of putting your money with these guys, and that's why perhaps there was less due diligence. It's almost as if you know someone, it's perhaps more of a threat to your investing than if you don't know them.
Now, I want to talk about the SEC aspect of this, Securities and Exchange Commission. Christopher Cox, the chairman, now says there's going to be an internal investigation. He's basically acknowledging some responsibility on the part of the SEC in not jumping on a credible allegation 9 years ago about this Madoff scheme, and I guess some other allegations along the way since. What is the SEC saying?
Well, the SEC had a pretty stunning admission last night that they didn't do everything they should have, and I think 9 years ago there was a letter sent to them saying that Bernie Madoff is running the largest Ponzi scheme in the world. So it's almost like those 9/11 tapes where I think someone in the White House got the memo that terrorists poised to strike U.S. targets days before 9/11. So it has that same sort of feel to it, that the express warning was given. As far as the SEC goes, you know, viewed in the context of the larger financial scandal or financial crisis right now, they will be, I think, in the end, largely irrelevant and largely neutered by whatever legislation comes out over the next 2 years that reforms the financial system. So, at least backwards, yes, they had warning signs. Going forward, I almost have to write the SEC off.
Now, here's where this video comes in. I don't know if you've seen this yet. This is a little video clip that has surfaced on YouTube of Bernard Madoff himself. This is from October of last year, talking about regulators and the SEC in particular. Listen.
There's always this friction that goes on between the regulating side, the regulation side of the industry, and the practitioners that say, okay, you know, where do you draw the line? You know, regulators would always, you know, and I'm very close with the regulator, so I'm not trying to say that they can't, you know, that what they do is bad. As a matter of fact, my niece just married one. But the
my condolences.
Right. No, very
did,
nice.
Did the SEC approve?
Nice attorney.
Okay.
But the issue is that they, you know, they tend to look at the industry as if you're making a profit, there's something wrong, even though intellectually they know that shouldn't be.
Well, if you weren't angry enough at Bernard Madoff yet, maybe now you are after hearing that clip. That's a video clip from YouTube, and it came from a conference here in New York last October. Dennis, some unbelievable things in that. I mean, one, that people would say that it's a disadvantage to have your niece marry an SEC regulator when you're running an investment firm. I might think it would be the opposite.
All right. Well, it depends on which way you view it. If it creates more scrutiny, then it is a disadvantage.
And I gather that the SEC says they're investigating the relationship between Madoff's niece and her husband, the SEC lawyer Eric Swanson.
Yeah,
yes?
Yeah, they are. And it's very hard to tell exactly when the relationship began and what influence that may have had on a specific move to investigate or not to investigate. It's just unclear right now. Again, what we need to establish is whether Madoff, when Madoff's alleged duplicity truly began, and what was the basis for that, and whether that included his family members and anything involved with the SEC. It's just unclear right now, but it'll come out. It's just a matter of time.
Also, him saying that he's close with regulators, that at least raises a question of whether he had regulators in his pocket looking the other way. And, you know, and then the part at the end where he's kind of dishing it to the regulators. Knowing what we know now about what he's been doing for some number of years, it's almost like sociopathic sounding that he could criticize. Oh, but the regulators, they always want to get you always want to look at you if you're making a profit.
All right. It's good craftsmanship, perhaps. One could describe that statement as. It does seem, I think, that a lot will come out about the SEC, and I think his connections to the broader political world still merit examination, be it people in the Congress or people on the level of state government. He obviously was deeply, deeply connected around the world.
He donated money to, I guess, Democratic politicians, including Chuck Schumer, who, of course, was big on the banking committee. I don't know if that, you know, amounts to anything, but it's interesting.
It's unclear. But again, you begin to understand how money works and money talks. And it'd be very hard to find someone very big in the financial industry who doesn't get sucked up into a scandal, who probably doesn't have some sort of political connection.
One more call. Bob and Elizabeth, you're on WNYC with Dennis Berman from The Wall Street Journal.
Hi, Brian. The scary thing about this is what other of these hedge funds, where people are making tens of millions of dollars a year and hundreds of millions, are actually Ponzi schemes?
Any guess, Dennis?
Well, let's throw out the outright frauds for a moment. I think what this does call into question is the whole nature, in some ways, of Wall Street and the investment management business, where one pays substantial fees, sometimes 2% of the assets and 20% of the profits. Those are substantial fees meant to pick stocks or make investment decisions. The financial crisis overall has called into question that whole fee structure, first of all. Second of all, the funds of funds business probably will not survive this financial crisis. If that business is about discretion, due diligence, making the right choices, then those funds of funds have revealed themselves to be overpriced and relatively useless. So this is going to have more of an effect, not just on the world of Bernie Madoff, but on the world of Wall Street and how it's set up and the money that it attracts people who are involved in its operations.
So since it all comes down to shoes today, I guess there are some other shoes to drop in this. Fred Wilpon, the owner of the Mets, one of the people who lost a lot of money here, is he still going to have the bucks to pay K-Rod?
I'm no baseball expert, but there will be other people, very, very prominent people, who will I know it to be true, that will be revealed to have been Madoff investors.
We'll be watching. Dennis Berman, deputy editor of the Money and Investing section of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot.
A pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, will there be room for you in Washington? I mean, anywhere in the entire city on Inauguration Day. Stay with us.